Welcome to the Bible class of Jews for Jesus with Bob Mendelson.
We are studying the prophet Malachi, the last prophet in the listing of the pages of the Old Testament. We talked last week about why it's arranged the way it's arranged with the football versus baseball imagery. Yeah. We finished why God chose Israel, or that he chose us, and we're using Israel now not only to mean the tribes, but all 12 tribes. We're not speaking specifically about the 10 northern ones. And we talked about the religious sacrilege of the priests, both in their service related to their sacrifices, but also to their spirit. Tonight, we begin in chapter 2 with the sacrilegious message of the priests. We're going to look tonight at the failures, or the sacrilege of the priestly message. The corrupted vocation or ministry of the priests is what we see first. The priests are the ones who are getting chided first. Later on, it's our turn. It's the people's turn. But first, we're going to see the priests. And that is the way it always is in James chapter 3. Don't let many of you become teachers, because teachers will incur the stricter judgment, the greater condemnation. Don't want to have people under you, or you're responsible for them. So look what he says here, chapter 2, verses 1 and following. Now this commandment is on you, and it is for you, the priests. Im lo tishma'u, if you don't listen, ve'im lo tishtasimu alev, if you don't put it on your heart, sim shalom, place peace on us, is a prayer that we sing in the Shemona Esrei. If you don't put God's word on your heart, he says, then you're going to be in trouble. In our version, it says, take it to heart. How do you take it to heart? How do you put something on your heart? What do you do that?
Memorize it.
Good. That's what we say. I learned it by heart. Tell me a little more about memorizing.
You have to remember word for word and make sure that it's precise and accurate.
And why do we memorize things anyway?
Because it's good. Whenever you want to say something that is spiritual, you know exactly what to say from someone that you heard of. Copy it as though it's like a tradition, and you say the words comes through freely from your mouth because you memorized what you have said.
So you're validating someone else's words from before.
Or from the Bible.
Well, those are someone else's words.
That's right.
And we are letting those words have impact in these days, though they're written 2,000 or 3,000 years ago. What do we do with memorized things? We repeat them, to be fair. But what do we do in between the times we memorize them and repeat them? What do you do with them? You take it seriously, mulling on them, musing on them, rehearsing them in our head long before they come out our mouth. There's a threefold nature of taking it to heart. Number one, you read it. Number two, you memorize it. Number three, you meditate on it. And then they become part of you. I use the visual expression of reading is like walking by a good bakery. Memorizing is like putting the bagel in your mouth. Meditating is like swallowing it. So at every point you can say, it's mine. You haven't done anything, but you've read it. You've read the text. You put it in your mouth. Oh, that bagel's mine. And that's true. And you've memorized it, and that text is yours. Then you swallow it. Ah, that bagel is mine. And it fills you, and it's appropriate. And that's meditating on the verse. Then it becomes part of you. The bagel is not part of you on your waistline or anyplace else until you swallow it. And the Bible is not yours until you meditate on the very reality of it. So that's what I think. You're right. He's calling the priests to do. First, they have to listen. In Lo Tishmu, if you don't listen, and if you don't put it in your heart, to do what? To give honor to my name. Sometimes people do religion so that they can gain popularity, gain fame, gain a job. Who knows why? But the whole point is to give honor to the name of Yeshua. And he's called again, Yahweh Tzvaot, Adonai Tzvaot. He is the Lord of the military, which means he has a right to tell you what to do. He's got an army behind him. You don't like it? Buckle your seatbelt. He's going to take care of you. I will send the curse and curse your blessings. What does that mean? Sending a curse, I think I know what that is. You think you know what that is, right? You're walking along, everything's good, but all of a sudden there is a curse. Something doesn't happen to you that you've wanted to happen. But then he curses your blessings, the things that you've counted on that have been already, and now that's depleted. So you're doubly damned. This is painful. And it's given to the priests for what purpose? Why would God want to curse the priests?
Because they're rotten to the core.
Well, that's the reason for the judgment coming. But what's the purpose of the judgment? To get us to turn around, to get us to change, to get the priests to say, Oy Gewalt, I'm in trouble, and Lord, I'm sorry. That's what he wants. That's what he always wants, for the priest here to say, Father, forgive me. I have blown it. But he says, look, I'm giving it to you because you haven't put it in your heart. You aren't taking it to heart. Let me give you a verse, Deuteronomy 28. Take a look at this. It's one of my favorite and worst favorites. It's in the curses on Israel, Deuteronomy 28, and there is a massive long list. This is called the Tochacha, the warning section. It's also in Leviticus. But the cursings begin right after the short list of blessings. Verse 15, Deuteronomy 28. It'll come about if you do not obey the Lord your God to observe all these commandments and his statutes which I charge you today, that all these curses will come upon you and overtake you. Cursed should be in the city. Cursed should be in the country. Cursed shall be your basket and your kneading bowl. So the in and the out, if you will. Cursed shall be the offspring of your body and the produce of your ground, the increase of your herd and the young of your flock. Things that you thought were growing are going to be cursed and fall back. And there's a long list, and it's going to fall into family terror and animals killing things, national tragedy in verse 33. Verse 34, you'll be driven mad, so insanity is going to increase. Our kings won't take care of us. You'll bring in a lot of seed, but you'll gather in little, so fruitlessness in our efforts in verse 38. The alien's going to rise up over you in verse 43. That's not happening today. I don't know what is. And then verse 45. So all these curses shall come on you and pursue you and overtake you until you're destroyed because you wouldn't obey the Lord by keeping his commandments, statutes, which he commanded you. They'll become a sign and a wonder on you and your seed forever. Why? Verse 47. Because you did not serve the Lord your God with joy and a glad heart for the abundance of all things. In other words, if we don't stop and say thank you for all that God's given us, a curse will come. Thanksgiving is not simply a nice American tradition on the fourth Thursday of November with some Indians smoking a peace pipe with some interloping Europeans, but it is a requirement in the Bible. If you know how little you deserve, when you get anything, what are you going to do but say thank you? And if you can say thank you for the abundance of all things, like he said, then curses won't come on you. That's where your heart is. You show your heart by where your wallet is. You show your wallet and your heart by what comes out your mouth. Thank you, Lord. Two things are happening in curses. One is that the things we don't have are then never given to us. And the cursing on the blessings is the things that we did have will be taken away from us. And it's all because of a non-thankful heart. That's what Deuteronomy 28 is telling us. Let's go back to Malachi. This is horrible. Verse 3. I'm going to rebuke your offspring and spread feces on your faces. Yep, it's as graphic as that. Offal or refuse is nothing more and nothing less. Let me give you some Bible verses here. What are you supposed to do with this? These Bible verses will be useful to us. What are we supposed to carry away for disposal? Exodus 29:14.
But the flesh of the bull and its hide and its refuse you shall burn with fire outside the camp. It is a sin offering.
This is what you do with an offering that is for sin. You're supposed to take all these animal parts and its refuse outside the gate and burn it up. Leviticus 4:11-12.
But the hide of the bull and all its flesh with its head and its legs and its entrails and its refuse, that is, all the rest of the bull, he is to bring out to a clean place outside the camp where the ashes are poured out and burn it on wood with fire. Where the ashes are poured out, it shall be burned.
All of the animal's waste is to be taken outside the camp and dealt with. Leviticus 8:17.
Then he presented the ram of the burnt offering, and Aaron and his sons laid their hands on the head of the ram. But the bull and its hide and its flesh and its refuse he burned in the fire outside the camp, just as the Lord had commanded Moses.
These are all the same Hebrew word, peresh. There's nothing else that it means. It's refuse. And one last verse, Numbers 19, verse 5.
Then the heifer shall be burned in sight, its hide and its flesh and its blood, with its refuse shall be burned.
So leftovers and animal waste was to be taken outside the camp and disposed of. So why would God wipe that on the face of the priests? What's he saying of the priests?
Because their sacrifices won't be acceptable.
Right, so what should happen to their sacrifices and to their dung taken outside the camp? So what should happen to the priests? They are taken outside the camp. So God is going to offload them into oblivion because they're corrupted. Their message is corrupted. They will not have a place in the community of faith. That's what the evidence of the refuse on the face is. This is all about covenant. That's what the Jacob I loved, Esau I hated last week was about. And so we see it again. The curse and the blessings are covenantal words. That's why it's in Leviticus, why it's in Deuteronomy. And mitzvah, the commandment here, is a covenant word. Curse is a covenant word. These are words that are used in covenants. And we talked about the suzerain, the Lord who conquers an enemy and then welcomes them into his family in a protectorate way, still with covenant commands and responsibility. I like that verse. The lips, verse 7, of a priest should preserve knowledge. What do you think of, I suppose I could ask, what do you think of when you hear the word priest? What is his responsibility? First, it's a he, not a she. What do we think of as a priestly role? That is a priestly attitude. What's a priestly activity? Teaching. When did the priest start teaching? Because in biblical terms, they weren't teachers, not early Bible. What did they do originally?
Officers.
That's it. They were the mediatorial body that brought sacrifices on behalf of the community of faith. And later, when the temple was dismissed or the Torah was too hard, they became the mediators from God to the people as instructing the people about deity. So they, the priests of every religion, are mediators. That's what they do. They mediate for the laity to the deity and from the deity to the laity. Here God says the lips of a priest should teach, because since Ezra's day, probably about the same time as Malachi, there's such great argument. I keep reading. Who really came first, Malachi, Ezra, or Nehemiah? It's fascinating to read, and it's all based on the argument that they're going to get to tonight about divorcing women. What do we do? So nobody's settled on it, therefore I'm comfortable in not being settled. But the role of the priest became a role of a teacher to interpret the scripture for the people of God, and this was new to them. So now Malachi is saying, you want to be a priest? Make your lips good. Make your lips bring holy offerings to the people from heaven. You bring people's offerings to heaven. Bring heaven's offering of God's word to the people. That is the new role of the priest that wasn't before. In verse 4 and 5, I sent this commandment that my covenant may continue with Levi. What covenant with Levi? Verse 5, my covenant with him was one of life and peace. When did God make a covenant with Levi? He never made a covenant with him. There's no use of covenantal language with the Levites until Numbers chapter 25. This is an unusual place. It's the story of Phinehas. Verse 1, while Israel remained at Shittim, the people began to play the harlot with the daughters of Moab. This is a constant theme that if you start dating the pagan women, you'll marry them, or at least play the harlot with them. So they invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods. The people ate and bowed down to their gods. You hang out with the foreign women, you will end up in idolatry. So Israel joined themselves to Baal of Peor, the idol that ran Peor, this section of Shittim in Moab. And the Lord was angry against Israel, and he said to Moses, take all the leaders and execute them in broad daylight so that the fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel. Moses said to the judges, the antecedents of these priests in our day, each of you slay his men who've joined themselves to Baal of Peor. And behold, one of the sons of Israel came and brought to his relatives a Midianite woman in the sight of Moses and the sight of all the congregation of the sons of Israel while they were weeping at the doorway of the tent of meeting. When Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, saw it, he arose from the midst of the congregation, took a spear in his hand, he went after the man of Israel into the tent and pierced both of them through, the man of Israel and the woman, through the body. So the plague on the sons of Israel was checked, and that day only 24,000 Jews died. the plague was thwarted at 24,000. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Phinehas, the grandson of Aaron the priest, has turned away my wrath from the sons of Israel, in that he was jealous with my jealousy among them, so that I didn't destroy the sons of Israel in my jealousy. Therefore say, behold, I give him my covenant of peace. And it shall be for him and his descendants after him. So it wasn't Levi, and it wasn't Aaron. It was the grandson of Aaron that now gets nicknamed Levi or Levi. So the covenant with Phinehas is the covenant of Levi. And how do we know that? Because it's called a covenant of peace. It's a covenant of perpetual priesthood, because he was jealous for his God and made atonement for the sons of Israel. That is a heavy-duty story and an embarrassing story. Think of it this way. If you are a flame and you're hanging out with an iceberg, it's all good as long as you're melting the iceberg. But when the iceberg starts to freeze you over, then it's time to get rid of that relationship. And that's basically what's happened here. The Jewish people were getting teased into and joining with these Moabites in the southern eastern part of the wandering. God said, I'm not going to have that. Remember Moab's mother. It was Lot's daughter who was both the mother of and sick. It's just sick. So that's Moab's history from its beginning. Now back to our text in Malachi 2:5. My covenant with him was one of life and peace, and I gave them to him as an object of reverence, so he revered me and stood in awe of my name. That's who this covenant of peace is with. What's his name? Phinehas. Not Levi, but he's in the tribe of Levi, therefore it's the covenant with Levi. True instruction was in his mouth, unrighteousness was not found on his lips. This is all good. This is testimony you want God to be making on your behalf. Phinehas became aware of the pagan festivities into which some of his people had entered, and he intervened in the manner described. So that bold initiative, God commended and attributed to him this salvation of the nation. So that's the corrupted vocation of the priests. Now we're going to look at the covenant that they violated. Chapter 2, verses 8 and 9. For you've turned away aside from the way, you've caused many to stumble by the instruction, you've corrupted the covenant of Levi, says the Lord of hosts. So I also have made you despised and abased before all the people. You're not keeping my ways, but are showing partiality in the instruction. We don't really see what's happening. If you'd lived then, you would know. We don't know. We only get a glimpse of the injustice that the leaders were living in, and by which they were causing themselves and then later Israel to stumble. All we know is that they turned aside from the way and caused many to stumble by Torah. It says by the instruction. What do we really know that is? That they turned aside from Torah, from Haderech, and caused many to stumble, Kashal Batorah. You've corrupted the covenant of Levi. What was the covenant of Levi? Listen to God, walk in God's ways, be even ready to kill the idolaters who are in our midst. Be ruthless about the holiness of God. And the priests should have maintained that, and they weren't. So the covenant was violated. These are covenantal words. That's why I use that phrase. It's Torah that's the basis of our relationship with God and his choice. Because of that violation, the priests were offloaded, and that's pretty bad. Then we move to number 3, the rebellion of the people. The people were bad. So it wasn't just the priests. Chapter 2, verse 10. Do we not all have one Father? Hasn't one God created us? Hey, 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 we're all in this thing together. Hey, we're not so bad, they might be saying. Why do we deal treacherously each against his brother so as to profane the covenant of our fathers? Judas dealt treacherously. Abomination has been committed in Israel and Jerusalem, for Judas profaned the sanctuary of the Lord, which he loves, and has married the daughter of a foreign god. Married the daughter of what?
Foreign god.
What's wrong with that? Were they daughters of foreign gods? But you become like that which you worship. And here the daughters, used in the generic female, it could be the males, that is, your daughter could marry the son of a foreign god. It's not gender specific, but they always used women as both the good wife, Eshet Chayil, as well as the bad woman who's the adulteress. That's just a proverb. It's just the way that it was done in those days. But there were plenty of women who could have run off with bad guys or good guys.
They did sometimes consider their leaders to be a god. Pharaoh was like a god. So it could have been that some of these other cultures' leaders were almost attributed to deity.
Just take Molech or take Asherah, any number of them, the Baal of Peor in Numbers 25. These were tribal deities, and if you belonged to that tribe, you worshiped that deity, and your children were dedicated to that deity, and you made them pass through the fire, or you made them pass through some kind of ceremony, and they were now belonging to the deity. The daughter of a foreign god means a daughter dedicated or consecrated to a false religion. They were idolaters and demonized. That's right. Therefore, they are not just daughters of foreign enemies or foreign peoples or foreign lands, but they are daughters of foreign gods. And that's why it was always a thwart that God put up, saying, no, 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 don't do that. Don't marry them because they will make you worship their false gods. Idolatry was always linked with the adultery of the marriage pool, if you will, within Israel. So here we see the rebellion of the people first. The covenant is disrupted. It's always in covenantal terms. Malachi is serious about that. Israel, you are responsible, even though your priests have blown it. You personally are responsible. So if you say, go to a synagogue and the rabbi is a godless man, if you go to a church and the priest or the minister is a godless man, if he's someone or she's someone who might be spoken of here in the text, you, however, though you attend there, are still responsible for your own action or inaction. Cursed are you if you don't do things from a full, joyful heart in serving. The idea of covenant fatherhood is found first in Exodus chapter 4, because we see here that he says of us that we all have one father. This is the people saying, don't we all have one father? This isn't the modern phrase, the universal fatherhood of God or brotherhood of man or something, kind of what the UN is built on. It's not that idea at all, that all people are, because this is covenantal. This is the Jewish people who see themselves, ourselves, as covenantally related son to father. When does that come out? First, Exodus 4, when God says, Israel is my son. Israel is my son, my firstborn. Let my son go that he may serve. Isaiah says this in chapter 63. He links Yahweh as father with his redemption of Israel. It's in Isaiah 63, verse 16. You, O Yahweh, are our father. Our redeemer from of old is your name. So this idea of fatherhood and redemption, which is covenantal, are good and well linked there. Isaiah, probably a contemporary of Malachi, maybe not. At least they use so much of the same language.
Maybe Malachi studied that.
That may well be. His language is so skillfully similar. I like Alfred Edersheim. I read his 19th century stuff. And if my language sometimes sounds like him, well, there you go. It makes sense. And early 20th century is Oswald Chambers. And I know I say things that come right out of his devotions. That's it. It may well be that Isaiah was a studied scroll. The covenant is disrupted. How? By marrying out. That's it. This is the main way. The point is that the whole nation has become treacherous in marrying outside the strict parameters of the covenant. Let's do some more. Exodus 34, 15 and 16. Deuteronomy 7, 3.
Otherwise, you might make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land, and they would play the harlot with the gods and sacrifice to their gods. And someone might invite you to eat of his sacrifice, and you might take some of his daughters for your sons, and his daughters might play the harlot with their gods, and cause your sons also to play the harlot with their gods. You shall make for yourself no molten gods.
Yes, so you get the idea. Idolatry is clearly linked to wrong marriage. Okay, and Deuteronomy 7:3.
Furthermore, you shall not intermarry. You shall not give your daughters to their sons, nor shall you take their daughters for your sons.
You get the idea. It's everywhere in the Old Testament. Now, by the time of Ezra the priest, Ezra the scribe, what he said was, if you want to get this right, divorce your foreign wives. And they, to a man, did. They all divorced their wives and went back to living as Jews, not in an idolatrous way. Nehemiah did not command divorce, but issued a stern warning about what would happen were the practice to continue, because he said it would be like Solomon. Nehemiah called the people to remember the history of King Solomon, who didn't do so well with foreign women. The covenant is ruined, disrupted, but it's also demonstrated or described in verses 14 through 16. And this is only as far as we're going to get tonight. There's another thing you do, a second thing, Shani. You cover the altar of the Lord with tears, weeping, groaning, because he no longer regards your offering. You say, why? What did I do? It should be embarrassing to a person to say, I never did anything wrong. This afternoon, a fellow comes in the shop, and he's telling me, his name is Patrick, he was raised Roman Catholic, he is no practicing Catholic at all, but he comes in, after 20 minutes, I find out that he really wants to know a little about Jews for Jesus. And why does it take 20 minutes for me to discover that? Because for 20 minutes he's been telling me about all the bad hypocrites whom he's encountered all his life, who never listen to his opinions, who have nothing good to say about each other, yada yada. And he spends 20 minutes deriding these people. And I think, wow, what a cursed life this man has. He's so angry. One of them, whom he mentions, is his ex-father-in-law, who's been dead for years, against whom he's still holding serious grudges and hostility. I mean, he's burning in anger. So I'm listening to this. Finally, after 20 minutes, I say, why'd you come in here today? And after a few minutes of bumbling, he said, to learn a little about us. I said, usually people learn if they ask questions, not if they ramble on about their hostile life. You've spent 20 minutes telling me about every woeful hypocrite against whom you have great problems, and I don't know that I've answered any questions because, you didn't ask one. It was shocking. I said, here's the deal. He said, what's Jews for Jesus? How long have you been around? Here's the deal. We know that we're sinners and we need to be forgiven. So I'm not that bad. There you go. There's your first sin of the day. If you didn't know that, the first one I'm going to list, but he's got plenty others. Look, the closer you get to God, the more you know how far you are from God. We are so far from heaven and heaven's accomplishments that a humble man would never boast about how holy he is. All we can say is, woe is me, I am undone. And I dwell among the people who can't help me get better. Profaning the covenant. What is profaning? When we said no profanity, it's a sacrilege. It's religion that's off base. I want to say it's mingling. It's adulterating religion with wrong religion. Mezcla. There's no better word than the good Spanish word of a mixture that ought not to be. And here the people are secularizing the covenant so that it loses its authority. They're profaning it by not keeping it holy. And look at this example. What did one do? Verse 15. What did that one do while he was seeking a godly offspring? Who is that one? He's referencing somebody. Verse 15. What did that one do who was seeking a godly offspring? That's Abraham. What did that one do? He was committed to the Lord. He prayed. He sought God. Now, he messed up, didn't he? First with Hagar, the handmaid of Sarah. And that has been a perpetual problem to the Jewish people ever since. So he uses Abraham as a good, bad example. Because here's what was happening. The Jewish people were marrying Jewish girls, but then they were seeing the Moabites or the Edomites or these otherites who were around, and they were divorcing their Jewish wife and taking a foreign wife. That's why God says, clearly, I hate divorce. And him who covers his garment with wrong, don't deal treacherously. Because everyone who says that what's evil is good and good is evil sounds again like Isaiah chapter 5. Isaiah says the exact same phrase. This is what we were doing. Verse 14. For what reason? Because the Lord has been a witness between you and the wife of your youth, against whom you've dealt treacherously. She was your companion, and you offloaded her so that you could go get a foreign wife. Not the way it ought to be. Don't do it. And what did one do while he was seeking a godly offspring? Take heed then to your spirit. See, Abraham did it backwards, and that was wrong. Don't do that. And let no one deal treacherously against the wife of your youth. So take care of that little lady. Chapter 2, verse 17. You've wearied the Lord with your words. Isn't that terrible? Wearied the Lord with your words? What do you use your words when you're talking to the Almighty? What's that called? Praying. Your prayers are wearying. You've wearied the Lord with your word. What you say is annoying him. You say, what did I ever do? How have we wearied him? Listen to the I'm okay nature of the Jewish noise here, if you will. Two problems. Everyone who does evil is good in the sight of the Lord, and he delights in them. Or, where is the God of justice? These are the two complaints. God doesn't care if we switch our morals, our right, our wrong sense. Evil is good, good is evil. This sounds so much like today, I can't fathom how 2012 it is. You don't know what's right and wrong. You don't know if marriage is going to be same-sex or not in the government next week. You don't know if somebody can divorce his parents is going to go through parliament. Why not bestiality? I love my little cow. There's nothing out of bounds. When the world loses its social mores and tosses its standards, then anything is okay. And if everything's okay, then nothing's wrong. Good is evil. Evil is good. And when you are saying there is a standard, then you become a harbinger of intolerance. And intolerance, then, is the worst evil in the world. Instead of righteousness being the standard, tolerance is the standard. And the second concern is the God of justice. God who brings justice is not available, they say. Therefore, he probably doesn't exist. Or if he does, he's out to lunch. God's answer to that, God's answer to the self-deceit of their resisting God, my messenger. How do you say my messenger in Hebrew? Malachi. What's the name of the book? There you go. It's all about the messenger. My messenger. It's not just a messenger. It's the messenger from heaven. And it's used twice in verse 1, if I remember right, of chapter 3. I'm going to send my messenger. He'll clear the way before me. The Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple. Doesn't this sound like Handel's Messiah? And the Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple, and the messenger of the covenant. Ah, there it is again. The messenger of the covenant, in whom you delight, behold, he's coming. That's John the Baptist. We see that in chapter 4, verse 3, that he's Elijah the prophet. But this is God's answer to the where is the God of justice, and everyone that does evil is okay. God's answer? Judgment is coming. And it's coming in the form of a person. And if you read the ministry of John the Baptizer in chapter 3 of Matthew, you'll see it most clearly that he says the act is laid at the root of the trees. I'm coming to divide father and mother and brother and sister. You know, I'm coming to separate families because justice is coming. And it is not going to be all peace and harmony and singing around campfires. It's going to be painfully disruptive when the Messiah comes. And I'm just here to rile things up a bit. There will be one who's coming. I'm not even worthy to untie his shoestrings. He's going to make it clearer and clearer. And we are all in deep trouble, I want to say, especially you, who, verse 2, can endure the day of his coming? Who can stand when he appears? He's talking about the one who's coming. So the messenger who's going to level things, that's what it means in verse 1, clear the way before me. He will pana, the same word that's used in Isaiah 40, of the mountains made low and the low mountains high. He'll make it even, Stephen. He'll moderate. And Jewish people were disqualifying ourselves from our relationship with God as Yahweh. So he uses this phrase, and the Lord whom you seek, it's the word Adon. It's not the God of it all, will suddenly come to his temple. Adon, just a master, is going to come. Fascinating change. Adon is not a covenantal word. Yahweh is the covenantal name of God. So he says, you guys have disqualified yourselves from the covenant. You're not even in relationship with God. And all you're going to get is Adon, the Greek word for Adon, Kyrios, Lord. Well, we're going to come back to this point next week, but it's necessary now to pause and talk about the cleaning and refining, not done by the messenger as such, but the one who's coming after him. We'll get to that. I'm really excited for this. The messenger is what Malachi is all about, which is what his name means. And he's announcing that one is coming who will deal with you. In other words, I don't have to deal with you, he says. God's going to deal with you, and with himself he'll deal with you. This is an exciting answer to the self-deceit of the Jewish people in that day. The hard thing is for us to admit our own defeat, our own self-delusion, and God help us to admit that. We cry out for his involvement in our lives and changing of our lives. So if you're listening online right now where you are, ask God to forgive you of your sins and make you righteous with him in the name of Yeshua.
You've been listening to the Bible class of Jews for Jesus in Australia. For more information, contact Jews for Jesus, Post Office Box 925, Sydney, Australia 2001. God bless you.